am Black Success.
You're listening to Trailblazers.fm, an interview-styled podcast that delves deep into bold conversations with successful Black entrepreneurs and leaders. Join us to learn actionable strategies, viable tactics, and innovative tools that you can put to use immediately on your journey to blazing your trail. And now, here's your host, my husband, Stephen A. Hart.
Good morning, and good morning, and welcome to a special series honoring Black women during Women's History Month. I'm Jennifer Witter, the CEO and founder of the Borland Group, a boutique public relations agency and the producer host for this wonderful series. Today's conversation promises to be just as engaging and informative as our previous three talks. Now, we've all heard the horror stories of racial disparities in medicine. It was most starkly seen during the early days of COVID, when Black and Brown communities were absolutely devastated by the virus. Let me share with you some pretty ugly facts. According to the Library of the National Institutes of Health, quote, analysis of racial trends from the summer of 2020 suggests that infection and death rates in Black counties were 3 and 6 times those in predominantly white counties, respectively, close quote. And here's this. In its report, Racial and Ethnic Health Disparities Related to COVID-19, the Journal of the American Medical Association says that, quote, Black, Hispanic, and Asian people have substantially higher rates of infection, hospitalization, and death compared with white people, close quote. That's pretty upsetting. And while we are hopefully emerging from the worst of the pandemic, these differences in health outcomes are still here because historically, we people of color have received the short end of the stick when it comes to health equity. And that's where Dr. Oni Blackstock comes in. Dr. Blackstock is a recognized thought leader and influencer in the areas of health equity and HIV. She is a primary care and HIV physician and the founder and executive director of Health Justice, a racial and health equity consulting firm that just celebrated its first anniversary. It helps healthcare and public health organizations to center anti-racism in the workplace and to reduce health inequities in the communities they serve. She previously served as assistant commissioner at the New York City Health Department, where she led the city's response to the HIV epidemic. Prior to that, she was an assistant professor of medicine in a division of general internal medicine at Montefiore Medical Center, where she led and conducted research to develop and test interventions to promote HIV prevention and treatment. She holds a degree from Harvard College, Harvard Medical School, and Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Blackstock is passionate about ensuring all individuals and communities have the resources and support they need to thrive and achieve optimal health and well-being. We're going to get some of that passion in today's talk. Welcome, Doctor.
Thank you so much for having me, Jennifer.
It is our total pleasure. Now let's dive in. Let's get to know you a bit. Your mother was a Harvard-trained physician. Your identical twin sister is a Harvard-trained physician. Was there any chance you would not become a Harvard-trained physician?
That's such a good question. So, you know, my sister and I, when our mother was alive growing up, we were totally really obsessed with her. We could not leave her side. And really, in all seriousness, we basically, you know, grew up at the hospital with her where she worked. You know, our father would often take us to visit her when she was, you know, on call at night or over the weekend. So being able to see her in her element, providing care, doing what she loved was really inspiring to us. She would also take us to community health fairs where she would, educate community members around high blood pressure and kidney disease. She was a kidney specialist. And so just seeing her involved in all of these different activities and seeing her derive so much joy from them. I think, being a physician was always really at the top of the list in terms of what careers we would want to pursue. So she had a huge impact on us in many ways, including determining the focus for our careers for the most part.
She was definitely a role model, your mother. I can see that.
Yes, very much so.
Now, we've talked in this series about occupying spaces and being in places where Black women are not normally seen with previous guests, Teresa Thames and Ebony Reed. How have you occupied your space and what have you experienced in the workplace from doctors to patients as a highly trained Black doctor?
Yes. So, it's interesting, that question. I think about sort of the reason why I ended up last year, the year before last, creating my business. And it was really to create a space for myself in which I felt affirmed and validated. I had, previous to starting my business, I was an assistant commissioner at the New York City Health Department running the Bureau of HIV. And I was one of the few Black women who were in a leadership department at the New York City Health Department, which is kind of shocking given, the demographics of our city, are not reflected in the leadership of many of our city agencies. During my time there, as much as I, loved the work that I was doing, leading our city's response to the HIV epidemic, I was very much unsupported. I was undermined in many ways by folks who were higher up in leadership. And I saw, just firsthand the challenges of really inhabiting my role fully, as a Black woman in a leadership role there. And that is really what in many ways made me decide to start my business. It was just very challenging really set goals for my department without having being infringed upon by other forces and really being able to really fully sort of serve in that role. And then previous to that, I worked at an academic medical center, providing care and conducting research. And I think, my time in academia was also, had its challenges as a Black woman. I, led a lot of the diversity and inclusion efforts at the Academic Medical Center where I worked, but I was untitled and uncompensated for that work. I did that work because it was really meaningful to me in order to recruit, Black and Latino trainees to our program. I wasn't sort of acknowledged or appreciated for that work. So there were all these things that, have happened throughout my career that sort of pushed me in the direction of saying, I'm not getting what I need in terms of support and validation and recognition at these different institutions, one being a government agency, one being an academic medical center. Let me go, create a space or counter space of my own where I can do, I can lead, I can be affirmed, I can be validated.
Mm-hmm. You are a strong woman, obviously, but when all of that undermining was happening, it must have been demoralizing.
Yes, it was incredibly demoralizing. My supervisor, he had actually previously held the position that I was in and had been promoted, but he was still doing a lot of a lot of presentations, for instance, on our ending the epidemic efforts, often without me even knowing. So I would, see a colleague and they would say, oh, so-and-so was just here presenting on the work that your bureau is doing. And I was totally perplexed. So it was very painful. And I think also being in leadership there, I didn't actually have a lot of other peers who I could sort of share the experience with. I had one or two and their support meant a great deal. But, as you sort of go up the hierarchy, there's sort of less and less people who can sort of be there for you. And I was really fortunate when I started out in my role as assistant commissioner, I had a coach who worked with me throughout my time at the health department. And, you know, in many ways, she was a wisdom teacher, a counselor. She really helped me to figure out how to be strategic, how to sort of navigate many of the challenges. And I'm really indebted to her and still, speak with her and seek her counsel very often.
You can never underestimate the power of a coach who is personally invested in your success. So I applaud her because she obviously played a great role in your professional life. So praise to her as well. Now, you initially focused on HIV, and you obviously talked about founding Health Justice. What I wanted to find out, because your organization is young, for you to go a little bit more into detail exactly what it is and what your major accomplishments have been that you would like to share with us.
Sure. So Health Justice is a racial and health equity consulting firm, and I work with healthcare, public health, and other related organizations to help them with centering anti-racism and equity within their organizations, and also helping to ultimately reduce health inequities in the communities that they serve. And the impetus for starting Health Justice was really when I was, I had mentioned when I was in academia, I was, sort of leading diversity inclusion efforts at the Academic Medical Center where I worked, and then at the New York City Health Department, really sort of deepened my racial equity practice. I created the first racial equity and social justice initiatives program in the agency within our Bureau of HIV. And then, the pandemic hit and we had, there was the murder of George Floyd by police. And so all of these occurrences really sort of started just making me feel even more sort of impassioned about racial equity work and wanting to really focus on it in earnest. And the reality is, people are like, how does this link to HIV? HIV, I can't think of another medical condition that has such stark racial, ethnic disparities when we look at who is diagnosed and who is living with HIV. Particularly here in New York City, 80 to 90% of people living with HIV are Black or Latino. And we're seeing a browning of the HIV epidemic as time goes by. So we're likely ending the epidemic among white Americans, but Black and Latino Americans are still very much in the throes of an HIV epidemic. So HIV for me had really been also a lens through which I saw the ways in which, racism, sexism, homophobia, transphobia all sort of interact and intersect to place communities at risk. So this has always been racial equity has always been a focus of mine, but I really wanted to just focus more intentionally on this work. And, my sister, has her own health equity consulting firm. And I had a number of other colleagues who also started their own businesses. And I said, this is something I can do. And they also really encouraged me. They said, Oni, you're doing this work already at the New York City Health Department. You have, all the skills and resources you need to do this really, on your own and take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm. And your organization is young, but you're making such inroads and you're being so recognized for the work you do. So I totally applaud you and your sister as well. Now, in your reply, you mentioned about racism and, structural and systematic racism have played such a role in health disparities for people of color. What are some of the other root causes that you can, share with us?
In terms of contributors to health inequities, in addition to racism?
Yes. Go ahead.
No, go on.
No, because I was thinking about redlining, blockbusting. These are things that we know about them, but we don't understand how deeply they contribute to this inequity.
Right. So, I think that example of redlining is a great one. So this, we know that in, I believe the mid-30s, this practice of redlining started where, sort of communities, that were felt to be at sort of higher risk for potentially, I guess, defaulting on mortgages or that were considered more risky investments, were sort of lined with red on these risk assessment maps. And those communities, were communities that had even small small number, small to large numbers of Black people and other people of color. And so what that led to over time is really massive disinvestment and neglect of many of these communities. And we still see the impact of these different practices, in addition to other discriminatory practices, sort of different zoning practices that have concentrated various, you know, factories and other sort of pollutants in communities of color, that today, even decades later, we still see the impacts of redlining. When we look at communities that have high rates of different chronic diseases like asthma or high blood pressure, when we look at even rates of poverty, they still mirror onto those same communities that were redlined back in the 1930s. And so, you know, we also see, for instance, occupational segregation because of a number of policies dating back even a hundred of years that have worked to concentrate Black people, Latino people in certain, you know, industrial sectors. We see that Black people and other people of color are really more likely to have, you know, jobs that have are low paying, that have limited benefits, and that includes less likely to have health insurance as a result. And we know that not having health insurance also is a contributor to health inequities as well.
Mm-hmm. And let's not forget about stress, chronic stress.
Yes.
And, you know, everybody can say that they're under stress, and I totally hear it. And I'm not playing the tiny violin here. But for people of color, even without COVID, there is a stress that when we leave our home, we have to be constantly on guard that many whites are not aware of. And Catalyst identified it as an emotional tax, that when we go to work, we have to be on guard about microaggressions. When we walk down the street, are we going to be mislabeled or stereotyped as to someone who may commit a crime or may be thinking about committing a crime? Can you talk about chronic stress and how it plays into our health?
Yes, no, definitely. I thank you so much for raising that. Because that emotional toll has a physiologic toll on our body. There's this concept called weathering that Arlene Geronimus has studied in great detail. And it's this whole idea that over time, there is this sort of this weathering, this sort of taxing effect of everyday racism on our bodies that increases sort of the level of inflammation in our bodies, and with something called allostatic load, sort of just the stress that our body is experiencing, that then puts Black people at higher risk for developing conditions like diabetes, like high blood pressure, which then can translate into, you know, putting people at risk for heart disease. And so we know that weathering, or this idea of this chronic stress that Black people are under, is also a contributor to the fact that, you know, many of us have, you know, under these same underlying conditions that we've seen during the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, place us at increased risk for hospitalization and death due to COVID-19. So it's all intertwined. And really it's that this whole idea of like the body it keeps track of all of sort of the insults. And even though we may not always be conscious of it, our body is really absorbing, you know, all of this stress. And that has an impact on our overall health and on the health inequities that we see disproportionately impacting Black communities.
And what about, and, you know, this just occurred to me when you were, you know, just speaking about, I think it's called the trauma gene, that it can be passed on from generation to generation, that, you know, we were talking about redlining and, of course, Jim Crow and all the societal, you know, structural racism that so many people of color have to endure, that it can be passed on from generation to generation. And that, too, is a health risk.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think we see, and I believe that the field is called epigenetics, but there are, you know, changes to our genetic code, our DNA, as a result of these, the chronic stressor of daily racism. And this can also lead to something, the shortening of these things called telomeres on our chromosomes, that can also, you know, cause us to die at earlier ages. So it's funny how these, you know, we see these large, these structural factors, these external factors have really direct effects, even to the point of affecting our DNA. And that can affect our longevity, our ability to have, you know, long, healthy lives. So, you know, really combating racism and other systems of oppression is really critical if we want to think about addressing health inequities.
Well, health justice is relatively young. And what I wanted to ask is, what is it doing to chip away at all of this? And I say chip away, I'm not being disrespectful of your company. But when I say chip away, is that we're talking about things that have gone on for hundreds of years. And change is not going to happen overnight. But you are at the forefront of this change. So can you share with us some of the milestones that you and your company have been able to achieve during this time?
Yes, I'm happy to talk about those. So we offer a number of services. One in particular is called an organizational equity assessment, where we really come into an organization and collect data either in the form of surveys or interviews or focus groups with staff to really get a baseline understanding of how an organization is doing in terms of how equitable its policies, its practices, its organizational culture is. And we present those findings after, you know, along a 6-7 month process to the organization, along with recommendations in a number of domains, including how decisions are made, who has influence in the organization, you know, how equitable is the organizational culture, what about workforce equity issues. And so we look at a number of different domains and then provide recommendations to the organization that can then be used as part of a larger organizational equity action plan. Because many organizations, they know that there are issues. Many organizations are, we say, snow-capped, often have white leadership, but mainly people of color who are in non-positional leadership. And over the last few years, you know, many, many people and organizations have really been, have spoken to leadership and say, we need to do something. These things are not fair here. Things are not equitable. So, so these organizational equity assessments can be really helpful for organizations who don't really know where to begin, with, sort of guiding their organization towards anti-racism, and equity. So those have been really, rich and deeply meaningful experiences. They can be really challenging to get staff who often maybe oftentimes don't feel safe to also speak up. But what I realized is that these assessments are helpful for leadership of those organizations, but they're also helpful for people who may not be in positional leadership, because often this is the first time people are having a chance to actually share what their experiences have been like. There's a lot of trauma that we know that people, Black people in particular, experience in the workplace. And so just the process itself of just being heard can be very affirming and validating for staff of many of the organizations that we've worked with. And so that's been a really exciting opportunity to do that work. And then we also offer a wide range of equity-related training. So trainings around foundational racial equity concepts. You know, we don't, many times people have different understandings of what racism is, like what the definition is. You know, the reality that race is a social construct, that it's not a biological fact. And so these trainings help to get organizations on, you know, within an organization to ensure that there's a shared language and shared analysis for really discussing many of these issues, and also looking at racial equity in performance management process, in research, if I'm working with an organization that does research practice. So really across sort of the gamut of really providing support in the workplace around issues of equity for Black people and people of color.
And with leadership, you used a term, I think it was snow cap, which is, you know, the first time I heard that, and I'm going to borrow it if you don't mind. But at companies where the leadership is primarily white, and you go in and you start defining what racism is, and then you go in and you, you know, go through their company, are they taken aback at how much you're sharing with them in terms of the depth of what they need to learn, what they need to do, and what their employees are saying and feeling, and perhaps, you know, the lack of psychological safety that many of their staffers are not feeling.
Yeah, and this is such an excellent point, and it's something that we confronted in this first year. And, you know, it's a learning process. You're starting a business, you're learning a lot. And, you know, as I started the business, you know, I was, you know, getting my first client was a really exciting thing. I didn't necessarily do like an organizational sort of readiness assessment, which I think is really important, because if you're going to work with organizations, you're collecting data, you're going to be presenting them with findings and recommendations. You want to make sure that they are open yes. to what they're hearing and willing to change. And so definitely had the experience of an organization where when, you know, we completed the process and shared the findings, you know, white leadership had a great deal of defensiveness, anger, frustration, which I think really was about a lot of shame and fear that they were experiencing. But it just reminded me that what is really important in this work, and Tama Okun, who's a very well-known white anti-racist educator, had told me one piece of advice that she had is that make sure you work with organizations where the white people who are in leadership, who are there, are willing to change. And I sort of had to like learn that the hard way. But now that has really stuck with me. But just making sure that, you know, that there's a willingness and an openness to really listen to what staff is saying and what the recommendations that we have are. So definitely lessons learned.
Yeah. I mean, what I found in my talks that the leadership can say, okay, you know, we'll bring in Health Justice or Jennifer Witter, et cetera, and then leave and feel that they've done it, like, go. So there has to be that willingness to commit, but also yeah. to support and to continue the process, because a one-off is not going to do anything. I think that if anything, a one-off causes more damage than not doing anything at all, because it's almost like putting a Band-Aid on a bleeding wound.
Yes. No, exactly. And so, yeah, I think, as you said, that commitment part, that they are willing to take what you have recommended and implement those recommendations and try to create organizational change. That is something that, now when I speak with clients, I'm making sure that they are aware of and they're willing to make that step.
Now, what can we, those in the community, do to balance the scales when it comes to health inequities?
Yeah, so, you know, I think what's interesting is that, you know, health, you know, the contributors or the influences of health are multifold, and we talk about social determinants of health often. So it's not just having access to healthcare or quality healthcare. That's maybe about, I think 20%, the estimate is about 20% of health outcomes are related to, you know, having health insurance, having access to quality care, et cetera. But so much of health is related to, you know, economic stability, you know, housing. Is there green space available? Are there healthy foods available? So just to say, there are so many things that people can do to help to contribute to improving the health and well-being of communities. And so, you know, I'm a physician, so a lot of the work that I'm doing is from the healthcare perspective. But any sort of advocacy that people want to do around, for instance, around food insecurity, around housing and homelessness, all of these contribute to improving the health of individuals. So just to say that it's basically, there are many things that people can do to work towards addressing health inequities. And I know people often say, well, how can I do this? But just to know that there are many different like advocacy groups. So I'm part of a group of physicians called New York Doctors. And so we often will have actions where we either show up in person, we write to elected officials, we have different mm-hmm. social media campaigns, for instance, to raise awareness about the harms of mass incarceration, for instance, on mental health and well-being of communities, in particular Black communities. So there are lots of ways that people can be involved in creating a world in which everyone can thrive and be health and reach optimal health and well-being.
And what about the medical community itself? What can it do to help alleviate this inequity?
Yeah. So I think, it's interesting because often within, I think, the medical community, people feel very comfortable about talking about health inequities in, or racial inequities in health in the communities that they serve. But often there's a lack of recognition that many of these issues also show up within the healthcare setting, and that, you know, Black people and other people of color who work within the healthcare setting are impacted by these same systems. So again, I think there needs to be, you know, critical reflection and dialogue around, you know, what is going on within healthcare organizations in terms of whether what they're doing to move towards becoming more equitable. And so that's why I think health justice's work is so critically important, because, again, many organizations don't know where to start with these processes. They don't know what trainings they need. Do they need to form a racial equity leadership team? Can they create affinity spaces where staff can, you know, who may share a certain identity can come together to talk about their experiences in the workplace? So I think the work that we're doing with organizations, it can be helpful to address issues internally. And my sense is that when we begin to address the way that racism and other systems of oppression show up in the workplace, that then has a trickle effect to the work that these organizations are doing in Black communities and other communities of color. If they are approaching the work with an equity lens, with really centering concerns of community, with centering concerns of, you know, workers of color within the organization. I think those are the steps that really need to be made.
Absolutely. It takes a village. So it's the communities, it's the medical community, it's the business community. We all have to work together to achieve health equity. Now, Doctor, I'm going to ask you three questions that I've asked all of our previous guests as we wind down what I feel is a very insightful conversation. So the first question is, what do you do for self-care?
Yes, so important. So I try to meditate every day because it grounds me. It's calming. It's soothing. And just to say that, you know, we're talking about racism and these different systems of oppression. They really disconnect us from one another, but they also disconnect us from ourselves. So I feel that a really important anti-racist, but also self-care practice is meditation, so I can get connected back to who I am.
You know, I was reading in the New York Times and I saw somebody that was recently, that was you.
Yes.
And I saw in the article that you also sing.
Yes.
Is that a form of self-care or you just love to do it?
I'm so glad you mentioned that because yes, it is also another form of self-care. It's actually funny. Oftentimes, actually when I'm feeling stressed out, practicing actually makes me feel a lot more relaxed and calmed. And so, yeah, my mother, when she was alive, she used to sing. And so actually for me, singing also is like a way to connect back to her. So I sing actually a lot of the songs that she sang when we were growing up. So it's a way to connect to her and also, yeah, a way to connect to myself. So thank you for bringing that up.
That's lovely. I won't ask you to sing a few bars.
Okay. Thank you.
And my next question is, where do you see hope?
So I see hope actually in my child, in young people. They make me see what is possible. So, you know, there's such clarity that children have. So when I talk to my child, for instance, about like masking in the pandemic, he's just like, I don't understand. Why wouldn't people want to protect themselves and others? You know, there's just like, we end up getting conditioned out of this idea that we are a community and that we're connected to one another, but children really understand the ways in which we are all tied to one another, the ways in which our fates are linked to one another. So I would say that the youth and young people and my own child, like every day show me that there can be another way, a different way of being, a better way in which, you know, really everyone is, you know, is lifted up, is celebrated, and has like all the resources they need to thrive and be their best selves.
Wonderful. And, you know, you're in alignment. Three of our guests so far have said that it's the youth where they see hope. I couldn't agree more. And our last question is, who are the three Black women who you admire?
So I would say, okay, I would have to start with my mom, my mother, Dr. Dale Blackstock, who passed away when I was in college, but, you know, who sort of fought against all the odds and, you know, was raised by a single mom on welfare. You know, no one had any expectations for her. She made it all the way to, you know, to Harvard Medical School, practiced as a kidney doctor in central Brooklyn for most of her career. And was, you know, one of the most generous, kind, brilliant people I've ever known. So definitely my mother, who I thank every day for where I am. And then second would be, okay, Audre Lorde, who, you know, as, you know, obviously is an accomplished thinker and writer, but also is a Black queer woman and I self-identify as queer. And so just her being her authentic self in the times that she lived in, I find really admirable and would love to, if I ever had a ability to talk to her, talk to her about her experiences as a Black queer woman in this world. And then Susan Smith McKinney Stewart, who was the first Black woman who was a physician in New York State and the third Black woman physician in the United States. I greatly admire her because I don't know how she did what she did in the times that she did. I believe she went to medical school maybe a few years after Emancipation Proclamation, or was born shortly after. There was some closeness to when, you know, Black people were freed from slavery. So, and just the fact that she was able to accomplish so much during those times, I have great admiration for her.
Those are wonderful choices. Thank you, Doctor. I knew that this would be a wonderful talk, and I want to say thank you again. I know you have an extraordinarily busy schedule, and I appreciate your taking time to talk with us, to educate us, and congratulations on so many things, including health justice moving forward so strongly.
Thank you so much for having me, Jennifer.
Thank you. So with this conversation, we end this special four-part series to honor Black women during Women's History Month. Thank you to our guests, the Reverend Dr. Teresa Thames, Ebony Reed, Cecilia Nelson-Hurt, and Dr. Oni Blackstock. And a thank you to you, our guests, for being part of this experience. And a huge shout out to Stephen Hart, who generously provided his platform for these talks. Enjoy the rest of Women's History Month, and don't forget to tell the Black women in your life how special they are and to always celebrate them this month and every month. I'm Jennifer Witter. Take care.
Hi, I'm Layla. If you enjoyed today's episode, feel free to hop over to iamblacksuccess.com to access the show notes and transcript. You can also sign up for our newsletter there to ensure you don't miss any of our future content. We also have a favor to ask. It would help us a lot if you could take a moment and leave us a review for the podcast. Even just one sentence would really help and support the work we're doing and help get the show in front of more Black entrepreneurs and leaders. Thanks for spending time with us today. Now go get that positive mindset with an intent to rise above, go way beyond, and keep blazing your trail.
I am Black Success.